Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Well, today we're going to be in Exodus 16, so I hope you'll get your Bibles. We stop at a geographical location as they're making their way down the western side of the Sinai Peninsula. The name is Elim. We're not exactly sure where it is because we're not exactly sure the route of the Exodus. Matter of fact, we're not exactly sure where Mount Sinai is. There's been some scholarly disagreement. Some say it's up by Kadesh Barnea. Others say, no, it's down the southern part of Sinai. And it really depends on several different scriptures and how you take them. The traditional site down in southern Sinai Peninsula is the one that I hold to currently until more information is archaeologically found. This means the great tree. This was a place of about 70 spring and 70 date palms. Matter of fact, if you look right back up at Exodus 15:27, it's where it talks about this. So it was an oasis. But if there was 1.5 million or so people, 70 date palms didn't go that far, right? So it was a place for a brief respite, but not a place they could continually camp. There just wasn't enough natural provision there. And so basically what we have is them stopping along the way. Notice it says that all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, S-I-N. Now, many believe this wilderness of Sin is related to the term Sinai. The term Sinai is not a Hebrew or Semitic term. Some say it refers to the kind of soil or the kind of vegetation that was in this area, maybe a low scrub tree. We're just really not sure, but it's obviously that Sinai got its name from the wilderness of Zin. If you look at a map of the area of the Sinai Peninsula, you see there are several different wildernesses. Up toward the top, there's the wilderness of Shur, and over on the eastern side is the wilderness of Paran, and then kind of in the middle, down a little bit, is the wilderness of Zin, and then if you look on down way to the south is the wilderness of Zin. Now, the top one is S-I-N, and the bottom one is S-I-N. So Z-I-N, S-I-N is the way you distinguish them. They're two different Hebrew words. Now, they're going down to the southern area, apparently, and that's where they've been moving toward. Notice it says, on the 15th day of the second month. This is interesting that Moses makes such a important deal about documenting the dates. In 19:1, it's going to say they're going to come to Mount Sinai on the 15th of the third month. So they've left Egypt on the 15th, and so it's 2 months out, 60 days out. They've still got 30 more days to go back to the mountain where God said to bring the people. Notice, if you would, in verse 2, we have the characteristic of this whole period. And the whole congregation, the sons of Israel, grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Now, this is almost the theme. It happened back earlier in chapter 14:11. They grumbled about this. They grumbled about that. They grumbled about everything. As we learn from verses 7 and 8 in this chapter, it was really against God. Now, they're grumbling at Moses, but they're really grumbling against God. They were a slave nation. They were used to having things done for them. And here they're griping about their provision. It's interesting to me, as I read rabbinical Judaism, to know how the Jews turned this whole period of wilderness wanderings into an idealistic time. They called it the honeymoon between Yahweh and His people, because Yahweh was with them and provided them all they need. But during the experience, they were terribly gripey about it, just complaining about everything, had a bad attitude, always on Moses' case. Boy, it's something else. Notice verse 3. And the sons of Israel said to them, "We would that we had died by the hands, Lord, in the land of Egypt." Now, here's getting the idea that it's God's problem. Why didn't God just kill us in Egypt instead of you bringing us out here and dying of hunger and thirst out here in the desert? And you catch the kind of attitude they had? They weren't trusting God. They had seen the Red Sea split. They had seen the Egyptian soldiers die. They had seen the 10 plagues. They had seen the hand of God. The cloud was with them. And yet they continually griped. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Notice then it says, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. Now, there's two things about that. This is the bull of the good old days. The good old days weren't so good. They didn't have a lot of meat to eat in Egypt. They were slaves. Now, apparently, it's first to the boiling of meat. I'm sure the Egyptians had that, but they didn't eat meat too much. None of these peoples did. So it was an unusual occurrence, and no slave could eat all he wanted. They didn't have that much food. It was kind of idealizing the past to critique the present. Aren't you glad we never do that? For you have brought us out in the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Now, did they really think Moses went to all that trouble, got drafted by God, went to all that hassle to bring them out there and kill them intentionally? Don't we say the dumbest things when we get under pressure and tired? I tell you what. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven." Now, this chapter is primarily a discussion of manna. It's going to talk about why it came, how it came, how you're supposed to gather it. It's a very interesting chapter about the bread of heaven, in the New Testament called the bread of angels. Here it's called the bread of heaven. "A people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them." It's very interesting to me that the manna, along with everything else, is a means for God testing his people. Now, there are two Hebrew words to test. One means test, like checking a metal, like a coin or something later. And one means test by smelling something. You ever get the tuna fish in the ice box, make sure it's still good? Well, that's the Hebrew word here. Smell something, see if it's good. And friends, it stunk, I want to tell you. And the Hebrew word here is to test by smell. You might want to see Exodus 15:25. Now, what was he testing them for? Well, to strengthen them, to encourage them. I think the whole Bible is a series of God testing us. It starts back in Genesis 22, where God tested Abraham. We see that God tested Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. We see that God tested the early church. God tested the apostles. My friend, God will test you. God will test you, not to destroy you, but to make you stronger, make you trust him more. And that's the idea here. Notice it says, "See what they will walk in my instruction." Of course, the word walk here means lifestyle. The word instruction is the word for Torah. And it's going to be not the Mosaic law, but things about how to prepare this food, how to eat it, how to handle it. And God's going to give special instructions, just like he did in the Garden of Eden with the tree. Are the people going to follow it? No. And this is going to set the stage for the whole Old Testament being a series of man's failure to keep the will of God. That's why God's got to do something new, something different. That's why the need for the new covenant. That's why Jesus came and died. Man can't even do the very simple things God tells him to do, like picking up bread off the ground. He's going to blow it. Isn't that unbelievable? But it's so true. Just think back. Now, this manna, I want to stop a minute and say, but it's the word test. You might want to see Deuteronomy 8, 2 and 3. It's going to come like dew every morning, kind of appear on the ground. And so as we go through this, we'll see more and more about it. Some say, well, it's the residue of desert plants. Okay, there is a residue of desert plants that looks something like the way this is described. Some say, no, it's the residue of insects. And there is some insects that leave a residue that the Arabs eat. But folks, there's 1.5 million people. There's not enough natural means here to feed that people every day. Besides, there's going to be supernatural elements of when it goes bad and how much you gather and all of that. This is a miraculous sign from God. Now, could it use something that involves natural phenomena? It could, but it seems not to here. It seems to be a direct supernatural provision. Notice it mentions them. They will come out on the sixth day. When they prepare what they will bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. Now, here's the idea of the miraculous nature. If they gather too much, it's going to turn to worms and stink. They try to keep it overnight. But if on the Friday, when it comes to Sabbath, now remember the Sabbath starts at 6 p.m. on Friday, goes to 6 p.m. on Saturday. The Jews start their evening in the evening because of Genesis 1 and 2, in the evening and the morning of the first day. So they start in the evening. They're going to gather on Friday morning, and it's going to last 2 days. Now, isn't it miraculous that it lasts 2 days when every other time that you keep it, it goes bad? Yes, that's part of the idea. It's also God showing about His provision of the Sabbath day rest, and that he's involved in this, and they need to trust him, and on and on. Now, notice it says, "So Moses and Aaron, to all the sons of Israel, at evening," that means the next day now, "you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt." Well, they knew the Lord brought them out of the land of Egypt. What do they mean? No, the Lord's going to bring them out. He's already brought them out. It's a way of saying he's testing them. He's trying to build their faith. They're going to know for sure that God is with them, that God is providing, that God cares, that God loves them. He is the covenant God. That's going to affirm it. Much of what happens here is kind of like what Jesus does to the disciples in the New Testament. Many of his acts of healing and miracles were meant to encourage the faith of the disciples. Not they didn't have faith already, but to build on what they did have. That's throughout the Bible. It's your life. What's happening to you right now? Do you live by faith? Do you believe God's with you? Do you know he's going to provide? You say, yeah, but Bob, it's so hard. What do you think wasn't hard here? God is letting us trust him day by day. Our dependence on him is what God wants. Now, notice it mentions here, in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. Now, down here the letter when it says the cloud, let me see if I can find it real quick. In verse 10, some say this glory is the Shekinah cloud. Now, the rabbis called that term. The word Shekinah is the Hebrew word to dwell. This was the symbol of the presence of God during this wilderness wandering period. After they crossed the Jordan under Joshua, this physical symbol turns to the Ark of the Covenant instead of this cloud. But here, maybe it says the cloud's going to come out of the desert and show God's presence. Others say, no, the glory of the Lord is the manna that fell. and they knew God was there because the manna fell. One or the other is what it is. Notice, if you would, then, it mentions they are to come near. Verse 8. And Moses said, this will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evenings, the bread to the full in the mornings. Now, this apparently refers to the quail that God's going to send. Now, there seems to be two different occurrences when God gave quail. Here, not permanently every morning, but for a brief period to show them His care. Now, we know from secular history and from even today that quails migrate from southern Europe to northern Africa. Now, they fly it, and quails aren't good flyers. They're mostly land birds. But when they fly in, they're so tired from flying that when they land, they can't run very fast. They're so tired, you can gather them very easy. God dropped these quail, natural phenomenon, right on the camp of Israel. Now, the same thing is going to happen in Numbers chapter 11, verse 31. God's going to give them quail again. But there is a judgment of God connected with Numbers 11 that's not connected here. Now, they didn't eat quail all the time. The Jews were not used to eat meat all the time. It was a rare occurrence. So here we have God's provision. This chapter focuses in not on the quail one time or a few times, but on the manna day by day that started here and would continue throughout the wilderness wandering period until they crossed Jordan. 40-plus years, God will provide. Notice it says in verse 9, let me finish this then, verse 8. For the Lord hears your grumbling, which you have grumbled against Him. And what are you? Grumbling are not against us, but against the Lord, against Yahweh. Moses and Aaron weren't taking this guff. They said, look, folks, you're not mad at us. We didn't provide this. We didn't call you out of Egypt. We aren't walking with you. We're not your sustainers. It's God, and you're griping at God, not us. And that's true. And the people needed to know that. Now, notice, if you would, where it says, come before the Lord in verse 9. Now, it's interesting in this chapter that this chapter assumes that the tabernacle is available. It assumes there's going to be a place to put the jar of manna. It's going to assume this word coming near is a sacrificial word for approaching the tabernacle, with a sacrifice, obviously, or the priest approaching God to offer the sacrifice. Here, it just probably means coming close to Aaron. But there is almost a subtle assumption that as Moses wrote this, he was thinking back about the tabernacle that really won't be built now for several more months. But it kind of alludes to it all the way through here. Notice that verse 12, and I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel to speak to them, saying, at twilight. Now, at twilight, if you have another translation, I'm using the New American Standard, you might have the second between the two evenings. Between the two evenings. Now, what does that mean? Well, we learn, and one of the places we learn this is books like this, Roland DeVos, which deals with the social institutions of Israel and religious institutions. Between the evenings are basically a phrase that means from sunset till the time it gets completely dark. Now, it's referred to several times, particularly with certain rituals need to be done at evening, which started a new day. You might want to see Exodus 12:6, Exodus 16:12, Exodus 29, verses 39 and 41, Exodus 30, verse 8, Numbers 9, 3 through 5, Numbers 9, verse 11, and Numbers 28, verses 4 and 8. So this is used quite often between the evenings. Notice again it says, you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. The miracles, again, were to confirm the presence of God, the love of God, the care of God. Now, they need to see that, okay? Let's see. Notice down in verse 14, it talks about manna. It says it's a flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. Now, we're going to learn from this description that it's white, and that's where the word hoarfrost comes from. It's going to be a white. But exactly the shape of it, we're not sure. The rabbis, the older rabbis, said it was round. And they get that from verse 31, where coriander seed is kind of round. They say it's round things. Other rabbis said, no, it's more of a powdery substance. They get from verse 14, this word flaky. Others say, no, it means scales, like that come off a tree. That's why some think it's like the insects, the scales they leave. We're not sure exactly what it was. The rabbis say that the dew came on first, and then the manna, and then a layer of dew on top. And they use verse 21 to explain that when the first layer of dew melted early in the morning, the manna was left. It's kind of God's way of packaging this stuff and keeping it fresh. Now, I'm not sure we can answer all that. It apparently was some kind of a white, a flaky, a powdery kind of stuff that could be gathered off the ground without getting all the dirt in it. And so that's basically what he's trying to say to us. Notice in verse 15 it says, what is it? Now, the Hebrew word for what is it is a popular etymology for the term manna. It's slightly different, but the first word sounds like it. What? What is this? What? Manna. And so that the name kind of picked up on that. The Jews use quite often popular etymologies, not technical etymologies. Notice it mentions here that they should eat about an omer in verse 16. Now again, this book by Roland DeVoe on the institutions of Israel, there's two of them, one's on the religious institutions and one's on the social institutions. It goes into a discussion of what is an omer. Now I want to just to show you some of this because I think it's very interesting. It's going to say in verse 36, which seems to be an editorial addition, either Moses came back and wrote it in later or someone like Jeremiah or Ezra added it to kind of add to what an omer is. It says that an omer is one-tenth of an ephah. Now, there are 10 ephahs in a homer. Not an omer, but a homer. I was interested when I was reading Rashi. Rashi went through this thing. There's so many seals and so many cabs and so many logs. And finally it came out to that this is equal to 43 1/5 eggshells. that's a lot of stuff, isn't it? It's amazing. Notice we're in verses 17 and 18 then. It seems that we have another miracle here, though it's possible it's not. When somebody went out and they gathered this, if they didn't quite get enough, when they got home, they had what they were supposed to. If somebody went out and gathered too much, when they got home, they had just enough. So the Jews learned to get just enough, not less or not more. But now when Paul quotes this verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 14 and 15, he seems to imply not the miracle of God changing little to much or much to little, but that those who gathered too much shared with those who had little, so everybody kept just what they needed. So whether it's the idea of the Hebrews sharing with each other, or it's the idea of God making the amount right, we're just not sure. Paul interprets it, them sharing with each other. In verse 20, but it says, they did not listen to Moses. And some left part until morning. Now this idea of them not listening, the whole thing was a test. God wanted to provide them, but he wanted to build up their faith in him. And right here in verse 20, we see that some tried to save it. They wanted to save more till morning, make sure they had something to eat. It's the same ordeal of man not willing to trust in God on a daily basis. It's the Lord's Prayer of Matthew 6:11. Give us this day our daily bread. No, thank you, God. I want to pile up enough so I make sure I have it. I want to have my barns full, my insurance policy paid up, want to have a big savings account, and then I'll trust you. No, it's a daily faith. It's a walk of faith. It's a dependence every moment on God's provision that God's trying to show them and us. So here's somebody who tried to keep too much and it rotted. But disobedience. We're going to have disobedience in verses 27 and 28 where someone tried to go out and gather on the Sabbath. And so we still see that man is just not ready to listen to God. He hadn't been ready since the Garden of Eden. And God help us, he's still not ready. Even post-salvation man rebels. That's why God's relationship with us can't be based on our merit, our work, or our deserve. None of us deserve it. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. All of us continue to go astray. It's the provision and grace of God that all that keeps any of us right with God. Notice in verse 21, and when they gathered morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat, but when the sun grew hot, it would melt. Now, it seems in context that the manna melted. I wonder how far outside the camp the manna came. I wonder if it came in just a limited geographical area or if it went as far as the eye can see. But whatever it is, if they did not get up when they were told to, go up early and gather it, if they waited too late, it disappeared. Now, I think 21 is the manna itself, not just the top layer of dew, as Rashi and some of the rabbis say. Look at verse 22. Now, it came about in the 6 days they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, on and on. Now, here we have the miracle that one day it would last overnight. God's provision was such they would not have to work on the Sabbath. Now, this 7 day is going to be mentioned down in verse 26. The word sabbat in Hebrew comes from the word to cease, and the implication is to cease labor. It's my personal belief that it's hard to tell where the concept of Sabbath came from. A real good discussion is in Roland DeVoe, but even they don't know. The truth is that it seems to be connected with creation back in Genesis 1 and 2. The evening and the morning were the seventh day. But the truth is, we're just not sure. Some say, well, it comes from Babylon. We know from Babylonian documents that the seventh day, the 14th day, the 21st day, and the 28th day were special days. But that won't help because there are 2 other days that are special days that don't fit this 7 day period. And really, they're not blessing, they're cursing days. They're like our Friday the 13th, so you got to be careful of them. So that doesn't fit to the origin. In Egypt, they had a lunar calendar, but divided it up by sections of 10, 3 divisions of 10. So I think the week is uniquely Hebraic, uniquely Semitic. Exact origin, we're not sure. but we know it's very early creation. Here's it's mentioned here very early in the Exodus. Now, it seems to me this is the first time they were able to do this, because as slaves, they couldn't keep a certain date, cease labor on a certain day. They'd be forced to labor. So maybe that they knew about the Sabbath, but here they're institutionalizing it into their lives. I think the Sabbath is much like tithing. God takes one out of 7 days and says, this uniquely belongs to me, as a way of saying all the week belongs to me. And therefore, God takes one-tenth of our money and says, this uniquely belongs to me. And really, meaning all money belongs to him. And so I think that's the way this works out. Notice it mentions then, verse 27, it came down the seventh day that some of the people went out together, but they found none. Now, only the problem was the disobedience. The manna wasn't there, but even if it was disobeyed to get out and leave. You know, the rabbis developed all kind of things about you can walk 2,000 feet from your house, and you can declare that your new residence and eat a bite of your lunch and walk 2,000 more. They had all kind of rules about it. But the trick is people originally wanted them to stay home on those days, maybe because they wouldn't gather. I don't know. Let's see. Notice that in verse 31. And the house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed. Now, I don't know what coriander is. That's kind of an herb. It's used quite often in the Middle East. I'm not sure I've ever seen coriander. It's a round seed that's white. I mean, excuse me, it's not white, kind of beige. And so the fact that it's white shows that it's not exactly coriander seed. And it taste was like wafers with honey. Now, in other parts of the Pentateuch, it says it tasted like cakes cooked in oil. The rabbis had a real problem trying to explain that. Some said the manna could taste any way you wanted, that whatever your favorite was, the manna became that for you. Well, that's a bit much. I just think they probably cook it different ways. I get so tickled when they start griping about manna. We don't like this manna. We're sick at the manna. And when God sent the snakes in the camp, they really said, well, we like manna. We found a new book, 101 Ways to Cook Manna. I bet they did get kind of tired of it. It's kind of like a honey wafer, something like that. And I'm sure the women learned how to do it different ways, don't you? They're very creative about that. Then Moses said, verse 32, some said, well, if it says Moses said, it's somebody else recording his words. Well, the truth is, many times we learn from contemporary documents that sometimes people who write it speak in the third person. I think we see in many ancient documents the third person used. This does not automatically prove that Moses did not write all the Pentateuch. But again, my basic view is that Moses is the basic author of the Pentateuch, and there are some additions here and there, like verse 36 to me is an obvious later editorial addition. So I would say the bulk is Mosaic, and then along the way, people added to it. They got a little more insight or something, and that'd be people like maybe Jeremiah, or probably the one that Jews say edited the whole Old Testament was Ezra. And I feel comfortable with that. The Bible does not make a big deal out of authorship. It's just our modern linguistic interpretive techniques that tries to make a big deal about that. The Bible's inspired. It's the Word of God. It's eternal. It's authoritative. It's God's will for our life, no matter who wrote it. And notice it mentions there they're going to keep an omer full throughout the generation. Now, isn't it funny? Here's another miracle. If it goes bad every day, except on the Sabbath, Friday you can get enough for 2 days, how are they going to keep it in a jar forever and ever? Well, it's another sign of God's special provision for this. He wanted them to keep it. It was a way of them remembering how much he cared for them. And I want to tell you this. The Exodus becomes a major theological event in the life of Israel. They're always alluding to it, always going back to it, always included in historical rendition of God's acts. So it's a very important event in their lives. Notice it says in verse 34, to place it before the testimony. Now, at this point, the law has not been given. The word testimony refers to law. Originally, we learned primarily from Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4, that it was put inside the Ark of the Covenant. Now, some say it was put outside the side, but the author of Hebrews says it was inside. There is no Ark of the Covenant yet. It hadn't been made yet. It won't be made until they build the tabernacle. So again, like drawing near to the Lord, this chapter talks a lot about the tabernacle, but it's written, it happened before the tabernacle was built. Now maybe when Moses was writing back, he kind of telescoped those two together. We're just not sure. And the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years. Now the term 40 years, I personally don't think this is exactly 40 calendar years. It seems the word 40 is used so often in the Old Testament. Sometimes it's obviously an attempt to be literal, but most of the time it's a very symbolic thing about a long period of indefinite time. Longer than a generation, that kind of thing. So, boy, they ate it for a long time. And then finally you see that when they come to Canaan, it's going to stop when they cross over the Jordan under Joshua. And in verse 36, we have a little addition about an omer and an ephah. And I hope you'll get that book because I think it really gives you the measures and their ancient equivalent. By the way, we're not sure about these ancient equivalents. they change from generation to generation. They're kind of like colors and the name of plants, the name of jewels. They're different from generation to generation. They change from locality to locality. Like we have different names for flowers around the United States, the different shades of color. This happened here for the measuring and the weights and the coinages and the colors and the plants, and so it's pretty loose. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.